It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the Wiz and Cricket Weekly podcast. We've got a slightly odd show for you this week. We had originally planned to lead with a bumper county championship preview, followed by a short section on the goings-on in the rest of the world of cricket. You'll still get all that, but with the CDC verdicts into allegations of racism at Yorkshire during Azim Rafiq's time at the club released last Friday, we're recording a special extra segment with former England batter Mark Butcher and former Wisden staffer and CMJ Young Journalist of the Year, Taha Hashim. Taha, congratulations. It's good to have you back.
Cheers. Thanks very much.
So I'll start by summing up the CDC's findings. There were cases brought against seven individuals and Yorkshire County Cricket Club. Of those, Gary Ballance and Yorkshire admitted to the charges against them, while Matthew Hoggard, Richard Pyra, Tim Bresnan, John Blaine, Andrew Gale all pulled out of the process at some point before the hearings, with Michael Vaughan opting to defend himself. The first five were still sort of... the cases were evaluated in any case, and they were all found guilty on the balance of probabilities of some or all of the charges brought against them, while the case against Michael Vaughan was considered not proven. Taha, I guess let's go to you first. What was your initial reaction to the verdict?
I found it interesting in that it's looking at what kind of came afterwards, it's a story that's kind of emblematic of where we're at as a society right now, not just as a game, because you can take from it whatever you'd like. You could go down one route where and focus on the fact that Michael Vaughan has been cleared, and you know, some have almost used that as ammunition to say that all is well in the game and that you know, Azim Rafiq was kind of out to destroy Michael Vaughan. One prominent voice might have said on Twitter, and that suddenly that Rafiq has no right to be a racism whistleblower. Or you could look at the fact that charges against the other defendants were found to be proven, that there has been racism in Yorkshire, and that actually this is probably potentially a more powerful moment than what happened in November 2021 when Rafiq spoke to MPs and went unchallenged. Here there's been a process. His claims have been challenged and he has been vindicated. Overall, it's been a kind of surreal thing to watch play out, really. I interviewed Rafiq nearly 3 years ago now. He mentioned when we were speaking about that story about being out there on the field and, you know, those now famous words, I guess, of, you know, there's too many of you lot, that whole story. And in a way, I don't like that the story has become framed about this one incident, about this kind of one story, and framed as if it's almost a shootout between Azim Rafiq and Michael Vaughan. When Rafiq was telling me that story, I'm pretty sure he wasn't pointing to that one incident as the problem. That was just an example. And so to watch it play out as it has been is unusual, really. And this has always been about something bigger, really. It's about the wider structures to the sport that mean that Asian players are underrepresented in professional cricket, that Afro-Caribbean players have been ignored by the game in this country. If you want to just focus on Rafiq versus Vaughan, as some may have done, you're going down the wrong route, because we will see the game for what it has been in this country, for what it is right now, through the ICC report that will drop later this week. We'll learn more about what's happened in Essex going forward as well. So it's important to keep a kind of a bigger picture here and not get bogged down into that kind of one-on-one type of story, essentially.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that. And it's, I suppose it's an odd situation right now because this isn't really an ending, even though it feels like it from some points of view and for some people. But a lot of the focus has been on Michael Vaughan. I guess partly this is because he was the only one to actually defend himself at these hearings. So the cross-examination was, a lot of it was his lawyer versus sort of the ECB, essentially. But he also put out a statement before the verdicts were released publicly. And then he did an interview with The Telegraph with the headline, "I want people to realise what it's like to be cancelled." Look, you obviously know Vaughan from your England days and afterwards as well. I guess what happens to him from here, do you think?
What happens to him? Well, I'm guessing that he goes back to, you know, he writes for The Telegraph, so no surprises that he had a piece come out there. I'm guessing that the BBC will re-engage him on TMS and that his life will go back to something like normal. I mean, the cloud of this whole thing, the shadow of it will follow him wherever he goes for the rest of his days. But I don't see any reason now after that, after the verdict or after the non-verdict, I suppose, that he shouldn't be able to continue as he was before. I mean, obviously that will be up to his employers. You know, I guess the issue has always been for me, and before we even got into the point where it became a sort of a mano versus a mano type adversarial case, was that any time that this conversation goes down the road of he said, she said, can you prove what somebody said 20 years ago? Can you disprove what somebody says that you have said all that time ago? You lose the main focus of the issue, and the issue is can we make people understand? Can we make people view you know, the way that they treat one another, the words they use to describe one another, or things that they might call banter, or that horrendous word banter, you know, how things like that can have an adverse effect on people, and then how in terms of institutions themselves, whether or not there are conscious or unconscious biases in terms of the opportunities that people are given depending on their backgrounds. And that is the only important thing out of this entire saga, not whether Michael Vaughan said what he said, not whether Azeem Rafiq was right to be a whistleblower on this huge subject, because clearly he was. The issue comes about where the focus then went once the you know, once the sort of the trial, if you like, of individuals came to the fore, over and above what the main story of, or the main problem is all about in terms of racism, in terms of inclusion, exclusion, and all the rest of it. And unfortunately, as we get to the end of the case, it's good news for Vaughan. It's actually probably reasonably good news for Azeem Rafiq as well, because he's been vindicated too. The people, as Tahar rightly said, the people who want to believe that there is no case to answer anywhere in the country, let alone in English cricket, will think that they are right. And those people who feel that their voices aren't heard or aren't given the opportunities will feel that nothing has moved for them either. And therein lies the great shame of it all.
Mm. It's interesting what you say about the kind of the he said, she said, and that aspect of the process, because that has come under scrutiny as well, I think, during it, not just the people involved, but the process as a whole, I guess. I wanted to put actually a couple of quotes to you. So Vaughan said in his statement upon him finding out that he'd been the case against him not proven, he said CDC proceedings were an inappropriate, inadequate and backward step. One of the main reasons why I hold that view is because CDC proceedings are adversarial. They invite claim and counterclaim. They invite those involved to accuse each other of untruths or of lying. The inevitable consequence of the ECB's decision-making was that three former teammates, one of whom is a current England international player, were pitted against one another for what later became a public forum for the world at large to see. Despite being criticised by the ECB for not accusing others of lying, I remain of the view that no good can come of that approach. There are no winners in this process, and there are better ways, there have to be better ways, for cricket to move forward positively and effectively. And then Mark Grant Prakash, writing in The Guardian, said, after charges of, so he said, Michael Vaughan said in a generally well-judged statement that there are no winners in this process. To say that, you can only be white and never have experienced the kind of discrimination that made the process necessary. So let's be clear, the CDC vindicated Azeem Rafiq, having experienced racism at Yorkshire, having found the proper channels blocked when he tried to act, having his life turned upside down. After being forced to go public, he will have wanted and deserves for that to be recognised. The panel's verdict absolutely did establish winners and losers, which is what makes this moment so powerful. As I said, there's been lots of criticism, you know, of everyone involved in this the whole way through, including the ECB and the CDC as a process at times as well. The question is that you'd ask of someone like Vaughan is, if this isn't the right process, what is the right process when there are these historical claims? Because as much as there are, you know, structures at play and there is, you know, a culture of racism at Yorkshire and whatever that might be, there is still individual accountability, isn't there? And that still needs to be, I suppose, examined in some sort of forum, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess it does. I mean, you know, it's interesting to me that Azeem now wants to meet again with Michael Vaughan. They met before, didn't they? Before the case hit the headlines. And to what extent that is going to make an enormous amount of difference. I mean, the meetings and this kind of the comings together probably should have happened before we reached this point, in order for them to have not become the sideshow and the circus that we've seen over the last year or so. And in doing so, you would hope, and if the meeting does take place, which I hope it does, I mean, I can understand reasons why Vaughan would think that that's not a great idea after everything that's gone along. Then you can show a path forward, because the issue for me with all of this is not what the institutions do in terms of making amends for what's gone before, because you can't make amends for it. There's nothing you can do. But what you can do is ensure that moving forward, we don't end up in this situation again, because there are structures in place that allow people, first and foremost, to hold their hands up to poor behaviour from the past, and also make sure that understand that there is absolutely zero place for any of that going forward. And so if the two of them get together and can kind of publicly and with great fanfare, with a similar sort of fanfare we've seen in the court case, can get together and map out a sort of, you know, this is the road forward for the sort of behavior that you would like to see, for the sort of inclusion that we'd like to have throughout the game. And we have a prominent former England captain on the one hand who's been, you know, in the eye of the storm over all of this, backing up the pleas from somebody like Azeem Rafiq, then you have a road forward. Then you have a way to go. I think any time where you're trying to get retribution in a way for things that have got things in the past that cannot be one that can't be proven because of their very nature, you end up in a situation where you get mudslinging and the issue itself of being more inclusive to people of colour and making the game wide open to that becomes secondary to, you know, who's going to win this battle of sort of, you know, claim and counterclaim. And the whole thing is, you know, Ramps writes brilliantly. Vaughan actually, at the end of it all, having been somebody that it would be very easy to throw all kinds of accusations at, and Azeem Rafiq himself, have actually all come out of it pretty well in the end, the process by which we got to that point has left a lot of bitterness, I think, and from bitterness, it's very, very difficult then to sort of like to make the strides forward that you'd want, albeit that there are all kinds of things going on in the background. You know, the ECB, you know, with their programs are trying as hard as they possibly can to try and leave themselves in a position and leave the game in a position whereby the accusations like this will not come again. But all of those things are going to take a little while to come to fruition.
Taha, I wanted to ask you sort of what do you think happens next? Obviously, there is lots more to happen within the game. You've mentioned the ICC, which we'll discuss a little bit more towards the end, I suppose. But just in terms of some of these individuals, I guess, and it's worth saying that there's been some suggestion that had the five who were found guilty on some accounts come forward to defend themselves, that things might have been different. I mean, that might well have been true, but I think it's worth looking through the CDC judgment as a whole, because everything, I don't think claim that can be this, but there's any sort of wash, I think. Like the verdicts are all, they're well-founded, there's lots of arguments to and against all of them. They have considered lots of different bits of evidence in there. So I wanted to ask you what kind of happens to some of these people. We've still got various sanctions to be handed out, but beyond that, I mean, take one example, John Blaine has been found to use the P word on multiple occasions and is still currently the head of cricket at Grange Cricket Club. And we talk a lot about wanting, you know, rehabilitation and reconciliation. There is an impact on these people as well. But I guess, how do we move forward with some of these individuals, but also because it's easy to talk about the big picture, but there are individual sort of stories at play as well here, I guess.
Yeah, it's a thing that I don't think is talked about enough. There's so much of a focus on winners and losers that come out of this, when, you know, we not as, again, I'm going back to the, this is not just a issue that we're dealing with in the game itself, but as a kind of a society, it's kind of, how do we deal with these people who have been, you know, found by the CDC to have said racist things? How do we, you know, going forward as well, how will we deal with people who within this game have been accused of racism? Because things will, you know, we've got the thing in Essex that's happening, you know, more of these situations are going to arise. I found it really upsetting to read John Blaine's interview with the Telegraph, where he's, you know, he says that he's thinking about how his son's going to carry his coffin and kind of the effect this whole thing has had on his family. And it was upsetting to read about the effects on Vaughan's family. And of course, it's, you know, throughout this, it's been horrible to read about what Rafiq and his family have gone through. You know, it's all sides of the story, really, that everyone has suffered. I mean, you know, Butch mentioned it as well. And you'd like to think that governing bodies like the ECB will still try and reach out and provide care for these people. I don't agree with this notion that they should be cast out and banished from the game. And so that this whole story, this whole situation, it leads to kind of a lot of, I don't know, ethical sort of moral questions about what is the kind of grown-up process of handling this? Is there a way to rehabilitate these people while offering people who've suffered racist abuse the kind of justice they deserve, they need? And we're still trying to figure that out. You could see that Yorkshire kind of didn't find a way to figure that out when they, you know, when they were initially dealing with the process, because it went from extremes, right? It went from kind of almost ignoring Rafiq at first to then, you know, the sacking of the staff. Like, it's up for debate whether people think that's the right thing or the wrong thing. But the whole situation, the way it was handled, kind of spoke to that kind of the kind of difficulties of answering this question of how do we kind of punish these people, but then also rehabilitate them, and how do we also at the same time find a way for the game to move forward in a healthy way. I don't think anyone has still found that answer. I think the game is still struggling with it. And it's a very complicated question, right? I mean, I still don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, I guess especially in cases where, like with some of these, where they've been, what the case has been found proven, but they would still, you know, John Blaine would still say that the allegations against him are false, basically, yeah. Which is very tough. Look, that's not the last we'll say about this issue, of course. In particular, as Tars mentioned, the Independent Commission for Equity in Cricket has a report due at some point. You said this week, is that likely? Taha thinks it might be this week. He's got his ear to the ground. And that will contain a thorough examination of all the issues surrounding racism in English cricket. That won't be sort of a, you know, one member. That should be a holistic thing that gives us the kind of insight that I guess we're sort of looking for here, I suppose, and that will merit much further discussion. But for now, thanks Butch, thanks Taha, and we'll move on to our County Championship preview hosted, you'll be pleased to hear, by Yaz Rana.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. It's our big new season preview. We'll be taking a look at how the 18 counties are shaping up ahead of the summer. We'll run through some of the changes to the rules for 2023, pick out 16 players to watch, as well as giving you our predictions that I'm sure will age as well as ever. In part two of the show, we'll chat through some of the stuff that's happened in the world game over the last five or so days. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is Ben Gardner, Joe Harmon, and Phil Walker. Mark Butcher will be joining us later in the show, and Katia Whitney will be joining Ben for part two. I'm really excited. I always love the run of games you get at the start of the summer where there's nothing else happening in the English game. There are seven rounds in April and May before the T20 blast gets going. Let's talk about Division One first and who we think will end up winning it. Joe, when I was going through this, I thought there were probably six contenders and I couldn't really separate them that much. So Surrey, Lancashire, Hampshire and Essex, who all finished in the top four last year. Warwickshire, who had that dramatic final day escape, but have basically a new bowling attack. And Nottinghamshire, who dominated Division Two last year and actually came quite close to winning it in 2021 when the divisions were structured very differently post-COVID. How do you see it?
It's very hard not to start this with a cliche. It's a tough one to call, but it genuinely is. And I think Warwickshire are a good example of that, in that they very, very nearly went down last season, but bar for Liam Norwell's heroics, they would have done, having won it the previous year. You go back a few years to Middlesex, who won it in 2016, got relegated the next year, and have only just come back to the top division. So, you know, it is very hard to defend your title. Yorkshire were the last side to do that in 2015. So, I mean, Surrey look very strong, missing Jamie Overton for a good chunk of the season with a stress fracture of the back is huge, because he was their kind of enforcer of the attack last year. Bowled some rapid spells, got those breakthroughs, useful lower order runs as well. But then Surrey do have those hugely deep resources that all other counties would be envious of. Personally, I like the look of Lancashire this year. Have come so close the two previous years, runners up in everything last year, all formats. And they've added Daryl Mitchell and Colin de Grandhomme to their overseas ranks. They've still got Dane Villas. They've got three overseas players, which they can kind of rotate. They're not all available all year, but they'll, some points they will be. Keaton Jennings steps in as captain, who's a really impressive character, scored buckets of runs last year as well. I think the only potential spanner in the works is if Jennings got a call up for the Ashes. You could potentially see that happening with Crawley falling away and Jennings getting the call up, although Jennings' record in home test matches against good pace attacks wouldn't necessarily push his case that strongly. But yeah, Lancashire looks strong for me, but I think probably one of four teams. I think six might be stretching it. I think Warwickshire's batting, it probably isn't strong enough to win the whole thing. Hampshire will be strong again, but again, their batting looks a little bit fragile to me. And probably the same with Essex. Again, you know, Harmer, Sam Cook will win games on their own, but they had a lot of underperforming batters last year. If they can step up, then they'll be challengers, but they will need to make quite a big jump up from last year.
I suppose the one thing in Hampshire's favour is they do win a lot of games of cricket, which matters more this year.
That's true.
I wonder, maybe something we should do for the website, looking at what the table would, last year's table would have looked like with this year's point structure, because they won more games than Surrey last year, who won the title. I think they only drew once. And with that bowling attack, with just Carl Abbott and Mohammad Bashir, are just going to win lots and lots of games of cricket.
And they play in an aggressive way. And you're not quite as ball levels, but they do go all out for wins, and they have Nigel Donald at like number seven in their side as a kind of hitter. So that's absolutely true. That the change of rules, as Butch will come on to, will help them.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that's tough to work out in terms of looking at form from last season compared to this season. I think Surrey, obviously they had a brilliant team, very strong, loads of depth, but they did also just work out quite quickly how to win games of cricket in those unusual circumstances in the first few weeks when they had that new ball where everyone was scoring loads of runs. It wasn't at all like traditional new season English county cricket, and they realised that they could almost like Bazball, but more based on the conditions rather than based on it being a philosophy that they could go really quickly, they could stack the side with all rounders, they needed to give themselves enough time as possible to take those 20 wickets, and that worked. But it's not, I don't think that'll be how the team that wins the title this season wins it. And Surrey are also slightly less well placed to do that this season with Will Jacks being injured, I guess, yeah. who was a big part of that depth last year. So yeah, I think it's really tough to call as well, basically.
Phil, how do you see it?
Lancashire, I would say, are favourites for me. Saqib Mahmood will be back, fit. He only played one game last year. And they only just finished shy of the win of the championship. So I think by a nose, I fancy Lancashire. I also, obviously, you know, have an eye on Hampshire and have an eye on Surrey as well, of course. Sorry, there's so much said around this stuff. Did you mention Sean Abbott is at Surrey?
No.
No.
Okay, so, you know, he's a quality seamer. He's not got the pace of a Jamie Overton and that point of difference that Overton brings and won them a couple of games last year that they probably wouldn't have won without that quick bowler in the middle overs. I think Sean Abbott comes in and will do a very good job for them. Dan Worrell is an absolutely superb county bowler as well. So I think they remain very, very threatening, but they will be hit hard by England call-ups.
I think it's 5 test matches in the middle chunk that you miss if you're an England test player, effectively. So
5 championship games.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that's fixture clashes, so you could conceivably miss more than that if England want to rest you.
Yeah.
That's quite a good chunk of the season, really, to not have Ollie Pope, to not have Ben Foulkes.
It is, undoubtedly. But then in Jamie Smith, you have a very good Foulkes deputy. And obviously you have a number of batters. I mean, I was just watching them train yesterday, and you think that someone like, with Dom Sibley going there, probably as an AMLA replacement at number 3, but you don't necessarily know that for sure. Jamie Smith is also a good opening bat as well as a number 5. Someone like Ryan Patel, who's a very good player, might not even feature in their first 11. So they have options everywhere. That said, I would lean to Lancs by nose. And my dark horses are Notts. So Notts obviously came up last year, played like they had a grievance in Div 2 last year, and almost infamously, they were only in Div 2 because we went from results from 2019 pre-COVID rather than what happened in the ensuing years. So they were in Division 2 last year and they were pissed off about that fact, and they played as if they were. And there was them, and then there was space, and then there was the rest. They almost won it in 2021, Notts, with probably a less developed team than they've got now. They've signed Ollie Stone. Obviously, sick note, Ollie Stone. You don't know what you're going to get with him, but if he's fit, he's a match winner. His numbers in county cricket are obscene. If he plays more than half the games for Notts, especially early season at Trent Bridge, where it does do things, and you have in the slipstream, you know, you have Fletcher, who's a fine bowler. You've got Dane Patterson, who's a fine bowler. You've got Stuart Broad, who's going to want to play 3 or 4 games. I know he likes to say, I don't like to play too many before the internationals, but they're going to win games with that seam attack. The big question against Notts is which batters turn up and which don't, right? But if we assume that Duckett plays for the first six weeks at least, and will obviously be feeling great, he's a match winner for them at 3, or as an opener, but he'll probably be at 3 in that side. Haseeb Hameed made well north of 1,000 runs last year and batted beautifully at a good lick as well. Joe Clark is the interesting one in that side, because Joe Clark only made, I think he made 550s in Division 2, 550s, no hundreds last year. His white ball game continues to progress, but his red ball game has plateaued, stagnated. But he is a big match player, and whatever people might think of him and his history is irrelevant to how many runs he's going to score in Division 1, where he's motivated by that. The question for me on Joe Clark is not about class, but it's about how much he wants it, with England now a fading hope for him in red ball cricket. But if he fancies the challenge of Div 1 runs, then I think Joe Clark with his head on, batting 4 or 5, is a very interesting option for a side where they have a good top 3 and him at 4, and then they have interesting players in the middle order.
And a good spinner
in Patterson White, who I think was England's the best English county bowler, spin bowler last year. He doesn't get much press, but he's very useful. He bats as well. It's at 8 or 9.
They bat really deep. I mean,
They've got a good keeper in the boy, Moores, you know. So it's interesting times for them, I think.
I'd be more surprised if they go down than if they win it. I'll put it that way. I think they'll be more likely to be up top than they are to be down the bottom.
The one team that I wrote about in the magazine, and I no longer think are in the mix, is Essex, because they've lost their overseas player. Now, they'd signed Will Sutherland, who's a very good young cricketer from Australia, 23, good bowling all-rounder, skipper at Victoria, right? You know, son of James Sutherland, the CEO, former CEO at Cricket Australia. So, comes from good cricketing stock, intelligent lad, really developing cricketer, would have been a very good county signing, I think. Done his back, hasn't he? Announced this morning.
So, your curse, Phil. So you picked out Emilio Gay as your one to watch the magazine. 24 hours later, he's on crutches. And last night, you put Will Sutherland on the email to Yaz, and a few hours later, he's down.
So unless they can pick someone out that is within their modest budget, and we haven't yet heard, and I've asked them if there's any names, I haven't heard back yet. I can't see Essex really putting enough runs on the board to stick it out. That said, it is a result pitch at Chelmsford, and with the change in the points, as Ben says, then perhaps...
He was a good signing, but I was a little bit surprised, given how their season went last year, that they were looking for a bowling all-rounder rather than a batter. I mean, I wonder if this weirdly could end up being a blessing. Snater took a lot of wickets last year. Porter's still a threat. We've talked about Cook and Harmer. Feels like they need a banker in their middle order to, you know, if they can get a 1,000-run season from a middle order player, they should be right up there.
And it's an absolutely fair comment. I think the bet that they've hedged on that one, and obviously it's null and void now anyway, is that he would bat 7 or 8 anyway in that side. He's got a first-class 100. But it's still packing that middle order of Essex with all-rounders. But I think what they're banking on is Lawrence not having a stinker as he did last year. Critchley, who started well and then fell away badly with the bat, him having a better year. And Rossington as well, the keeper bat, 6 or 7, he's got the talent to have a very good year. So I think they've looked at it and thought, none of our decent players have had good years. If 2 of the 3 have good years, then we can make up for that again on result pitches at Chelmsford. That said, I tend to agree with you. The problem is finding, within budgets, finding players who are going to be available for the majority of the season, who are banker, middle order, 1,000 run plus sort of players. They are pretty hard to find among overseas players these days.
I think county fans might, their eyebrows might raise at some of the names that you get for overseas signings, players who, a lot of Australians who haven't played international cricket, but the reason for that is availability. Is they put a premium on players who can be around for an entire season, and you get secondary effects of just influence on the dressing room as well, that you get more than someone who just comes in for a little bit.
It still is a bit surprising, though, especially some of the Pakistani players who are available. Like Saul Shaquille hasn't got a gig, right? And I know he's, you know, he only came into the Pakistan fold over the winter, but he looked very good. You think if you're looking for a player who's a, like, sort of like a banker batter who should be able to just, you know, grind out,
he's not getting any white ball call ups
exactly. Yeah, like there are inefficiencies, I guess, in how those players are picked up, and it is odd that you get so many Australians. Like, you know what, Nathan McAndrew's got gigs 2 years in a row, and he doesn't set anyone's pulses racing as a cricketer. I guess it's it is surprising, and
it's a good shout actually. And you know, if any club's looking for a top order batter, somebody like Shafiq, the opening batter of Pakistan, who's a red ball specialist.
Only issue, so he's now in the white ball frame is the issue.
Oh, is he?
So yeah, he was meant to be going to Leicester, and then called up to the white ball stuff, or is about to be.
It didn't go great for him. Actually, he got 4 ducks in a row, and then finally made a 20 in the most recent game. But yeah.
Then Leicester got Pete Hanscom in instead, who, well, I've already talked about Pete Hanscom on the podcast.
You can't stand
that's a great signing.
I kind of think, though, with Essex, Warwickshire and Hampshire, if you have a bowling attack that just takes 20 wickets every game, you can get very... I mean, Hampshire nearly won it last year with a batting...
When Warwickshire won it 2 years ago, I mean, as I've already said, they can't win it because their batting wasn't that good. They won't be that good this year.
Yeah.
But their batting wasn't that great when they won the whole thing.
Yeah, I guess when I'm looking through the teams, with Lancashire, other than Anderson, obviously, who's probably not going to play that much, no one in that team is going to get an England call-up, or it's very, very unlikely. And it looks like they're drifting towards almost a Surrey model of having a team where you have like at least 3 all-rounders in between 6, 7, 8.
Right.
So last season, the former England under-19 captain, George Balderson, he opened the batting for a bit. He opens the bowling sometimes. 1 week he opens the batting. Next week he's batting number 8. Tidy bowler. Ben, a player you like, Tom Hartley, he hasn't paid that much for them, but kept Matt Boggs in out of the side for a bit with his bowling, but he also bats a bit. He could end up batting seven or eight as well.
Well, DeGranton might end up being a kind of a hitter at seven as well, which is an incredibly useful player to have in that position.
I think it's a bang on point that you make, and that's what won it last year for Surrey. You know, they were often 150 for five, but invariably one of that mid to lower order. Overton had a good year, averaged
Jordan
50
Clark.
Plus.
At Jordan eight.
Clark, obviously Curran, when he played, averaged 75, I think, in well, the
did
end.
Did they have 11 or 10 or 11 players scored hundreds from the last year?
Yeah. Which
I mean, that stat kind of summed up the top, year, I think.
But then aggregate-wise, I think Burns made 800 and something, but that was the highest. So there you go. You know, again, that's the strength in depth. But that's, I think, the way that clubs are looking at a 16-game season these days, that you pack your bowling all-rounders, you pack your mid to lower orders as much as possible. Know that your top few are often going to get one that you can't do anything about. And, you know, being 200 for five or six is not that bad a score, really, in top level Division One county cricket.
And just on Warwickshire, it was worth actually pointing out how good their attack is in, and not just their bowling, but also a lot of those guys can bat as well. So they've got Chris Wokes, who's not in the IPL, who's desperate to get back in the England Test fold, who's going to be available for a lot of the early summer. Hassan Ali, that's one hell of a signing given how well he did at Lancs. Liam Norwell's basically missed the entirety of last season when he did play, took a ninth for. And Chris Rushworth, you know, that's arguably one of the best bowling attacks in the country. They've also got Ed Bernard there from Worcestershire as a new signing. He's a bowling
rounder. And Dalby, who's been their best bowler for the last couple of years.
So that's a side that you can rotate that attack, and you've got guys who can bat at county cricket at least. Bernard and Wokes can definitely bat in the top six. So that's a very strong side. You kind of think, if one player alongside Hayne has a big season with the bat, they've probably got enough in there to mount a title challenge.
And they had a couple of guys who fell away a bit last season as well, didn't they? Having done, like, so what? Did
Rob Yates had a shocker.
Rhodes and Yates both made 400s in the championship season win, I think.
Yeah.
And they both struggled a lot last year. If one or both of those comes back into form, then that becomes actually almost quite a compelling proposition, I think. Yeah.
Mm. We had a question on Bahanan. Billy asks, feasibly, how many runs does someone like Bahanan have to get to be in serious England contention? Also, when was the last time that it felt like no one can really play themselves into a test spot at the start of the season? Which I think is a fair question, actually. Like, I don't think there are any test spots up for grabs.
It's a very different conversation to the one we usually have at this time of year, isn't it? When we're just speculating wildly and picking out kind of 20 names by the end of the show. Yeah, and Bahanan, I think, is not only are there not really spots for grabs, but the appeal of Bahanan, what, a year ago, 18 months ago, was the way he played, in that he was a player of solid technique, got his head down and would occupy the crease. Now, that's not what they want. Mm. So I think he's doubly struggling because England suddenly have a lot of players making runs, and also they make them in a certain way, which is not really how he goes about his game. Well, I think he did score a bit more freely on a Lions tour where everyone seemed to kind of get caught up in the Bazball ethos. But I still think, bowler-wise, I think there are still opportunities. I think just because more injuries come along to your seamers, it feels like the first choice are locked down. But I do still feel like there are opportunities for not maybe someone we haven't really ever thought of, but Saqib Mahmood, for instance, as Phil mentions, if he had a brilliant start to the season, I think he'd be right in Ash's contention. We can't really talk about Jofra Archer being, you know, a guaranteed to be in an Ash's squad because he just hasn't played Red Bull cricket for so long. So there are opportunities there. Ollie Stone is another. If he has a good start to the season, I could see him being part of the setup.
Mm. Kind of looking lower down the table now and talking about the teams that we think might go down, if it is the case that two teams go down. Northants were really hard to beat last season, but they also only won twice. And as we said, there are fewer points for a draw this year, down to five from eight, and harder to get batting points. The first bonus points at 250 runs rather than 200, and it's 5 points at 450 rather than 400. How do we think that Northants will do this season compared to last? Because I look at some of the sides around them and I think Kent are better than they were last season. I think Somerset are better than they were last season. Middlesex have come up. I think Middlesex might struggle, but I think Middlesex will probably do better than Gloucestershire did last year. So I think it's going to be really, really difficult for a side like Northants to survive.
I think any year that Northants play in the top division is a successful year for them. They did superbly well last year. They were safe with a couple of games to spare. They're a really likeable club. They're the sort of club that if you care about the model, in inverted commas, then you've got to really get behind a club like Northants. They obviously don't have a big ground. They don't have a huge fan base, but they make money. They're self-sufficient. They bring through good young players. They recruit well. They're the kind of club that evokes something of the spirit and the purpose and the value of the 18 clubs. This year, they'll do really well to stay up, but we'd have said that last year as well. They've recruited David Willey from Yorkshire, you know, something of a local hero. I suppose he will be a sort of talismanic figure for them. He's obviously not going to take a massive amount of red ball wickets, but he will win them a game or two, I venture, you know, as much with the bat from number seven as anything else. And they brought in Lewis McManus as well. He's a good sort of keeper bat from Hants. Clever, canny signing. The Aussie Sam Whiteman as well. He's a good cricketer. You know, he's got good numbers. He's 31 year old. He's a story, not a story, but you know, he's an experienced cricketer, and the kind of cricketer that they like. In the end, you know, if it doesn't happen for them in Red Bull cricket, then it's not the end of the world for them, because they have quite a thriving T20 side as well, and that's really where their immediate flourishing future lies. It might be that they're a bit of a yo-yo club, but that they're an absolutely integral part of the story, really, clubs like Northants.
Joe, you actually tipped them to just avoid the drop in the magazine, but that was when Emilio Gay, I guess, was going to play quite a significant part in the early season. Does that tilt it, or do you still think they've got the minerals to...
It does tilt it, and actually Yaz makes a good point on the value of the draw being that much less now. That definitely works against Northants. They haven't got a match-winning seam attack in the way that pretty much every other team in the division does. I had them at eighth. I had Kent finishing bottom, and who are my county, so I didn't do it with any pleasure. And Middlesex coming ninth. I think Kent's got a good batting lineup, but their seam attack really struggled last year, and they've lost Matt Milnes to Yorkshire. Arshdeep Singh coming in for half a dozen or four or five games in the middle of the summer. That's exciting, but that's such a short stint. I mean, if he's brilliant and wins you three games, then obviously you're pretty much staying up on that basis. But bringing in Michael Hogan at the age of about 74, who retired at the end of last season, doesn't feel like it's going to revitalise the pace attack. And now obviously he'll go on and take 60 wickets this season.
I'm surprised you think that, because they really struggled at the start of last season, but they did kind of find an attack that kind of worked by the end of it. So Matt Quinn, who's been around the counter game for a while, did do really well at the end of last season. I think Hogan will still do okay. And Nathan Gilchrist is a good bowler as well.
Yeah.
So that's obviously not one of the better attacks in the division, but given how good their top seven is, I think they'll be fine.
I guess I feel like I wish I'd picked this guy as my first team bolter for later on. But Hassan Azad is interesting. I mean, he's not there on a full contract. He's just there as kind of like a backup option for a few weeks while Emilio Gay recovers. But we obviously, there's lots to like about him. He's had done some really good things in county cricket. I think people were a bit surprised when he got released at the end of last season. And then even more surprised when there weren't sort of like a set of suitors after him. But he'll have a point to prove if he does get on that team sheet.
What do we think about Somerset and Middlesex? Somerset, kind of the same as ever, really. Like, brilliant bowling attack. Batting lineup is decent, but they're probably going to struggle to rack up the runs to challenge at the top of the division. They've brought in Sean Dixon, who had a really good season at Durham last year, that should make a bit of a difference. Cam Bancroft will be a good signing for a few games.
They've certainly improved their batting, burnished their batting. You know, to have Kola Cadmore, Dixon, Bancroft, they are three good top order players as well. So I imagine their policy will be to bat slowishly, solidly, and try and hope that the pitch starts to break up. You know, win a few tosses, bat first. Bat within yourself, in effect, and then try and win games rather than go for bonus points. But yeah, I can't see that they've probably got enough quality to bother the top end, but I don't think they'll be struggling to stay up either.
And they've also got, when it comes to just winning games at the end of the season to stay up, they're good at, you know, getting the surfaces that allow them to do that.
And also Craig Overton is one of the best players in the county championship. And one thing on them as well with their batting, it's possible they've got a couple of really highly rated young batting talents who you never know could make that big step, take that big step up.
James Rue's a good young player. When we did fielded the captain's round table for the magazine, Sam Billings picked him out as a young player to watch, particularly in Red Bull cricket this summer. And yeah, he displaced Steve Davis, was keeping by the end of last season. I think Somerset, yeah, they're one of those sides that I think it's really hard to pick. I think that actually, if a couple of batters come off, they could be right near the top of the division, but they just haven't done that really. Last year, if it wasn't for Tom Abel, they'd be in Division 2 this year, and he had a brilliant year.
And finally, on Division 1, how do we think Middlesex is going to do on their return to the top flight?
Go on, Joe. You've got them going down.
Well, I had them going down just because they've struggled so much in Division 2 and they didn't win a whole stack of games last year. They were very nearly pipped by Glamorgan and they haven't massively strengthened their side to make me think that they're going to score enough runs to stay up. They were meant to be getting Keshav Maharaj in for a good chunk of the season and he injured himself celebrating a wicket for South Africa, so he's out. And batting wise, they've got Peter Milan, the South African back, who did okay last year without kind of pulling up any trees. It just feels like they're going to struggle to win enough games. And again, with the value of the draw being diminished, they might be struggling. I think Toby Roden-Jones will no doubt take a stack of wickets and Murta will continue to do what he does, but they just look a bit weaker than most. Maybe on paper, I think Northants the only side that look weaker. But Northants have a clear, defined way of playing, which has served them well. I'm not sure Middlesex quite have that yet.
No, I think I agree with that.
Yeah, because there was the financial troubles in there that was, I guess, revealed by Will McPherson in the in the Telegraph, and I guess revealed itself maybe over the course of the off season, which has probably impacted their ability to strengthen to try and make the push to stay in the division. I guess
they've brought in Ryan Higgins, who has a brilliant few years. Who began at Middlesex, had a brilliant few years at Gloucester. He'll be a useful player for them. But I tend to echo Joe. Yeah, I think they're going to struggle a little bit, certainly for runs.
Before we go to Division 2 and our ones to watch, there are a few changes, as we've mentioned, this year in the county championship. Let's go to Mark Butcher to hear his thoughts on them. Cool. Butch, before I get you on the rule changes coming up this summer, let's hear who you think is going to win Division 1. I don't think we're going to be awfully surprised by who you've gone for, but let's hear why.
I'm going to go for Surrey, aren't I? It's very, very difficult to go back to back, as lots of teams have found out over the years. But I think they're a terrific club, and they've got young players coming through to replace the likes of Pope and Folks. I mean, the news about Bairstow keeping wicket at the beginning of the summer for Yorkshire adds an interesting little subplot, doesn't it? To what England might decide to do. Etc. But the likelihood is, but even without Pope and Folks, that they're going to have, going to have plenty there at the Oval, and you know, Sean Abbott is a terrific signing as well. Notwithstanding the fact that it's going to be a really tough year, so I think look like a very strong side. Warwickshire's bowling attack looks out of this world. Knots are going to be hard to beat, and I know that Lanks are favourite within the. Within the office up there at Wisden, and they will also be tough opposition as well. We might end up in a situation where the weather plays a huge part in this early part of the summer. Let's hope that's not the case, and that we get sort of even days of play and whatever throughout from the north and the south. But the early portents are not particularly good, are they? This is normally the best part of the year, March, April, and it's been absolutely stinking so far. Yeah. So
the forecast is really bad ahead of the first round of fixtures as well.
So those things, I don't know whether that probably favours the southern teams anyway, doesn't it? Which I will say with a large smile on my face as well, because I'll get abused for that. But I think it's just the truth. So anyway, it promises to be a really good summer. And of course, you know, with players all up and down the country with an Ashes series, it always, you know, players always sort of like thinking to themselves, or if I get off to a flyer here, you've got half a chance if people get injured, etc. So, it should be something to keep an eye on. But I'm going with the Brown Hats, unsurprisingly.
Well, there are a few changes to this year's championship. So the Kookaburra ball, which has less of a pronounced seam and does a little bit less off the pitch and through the air, that's going to be used for two rounds in the middle of the summer where hopefully the weather will be at its best. Batting points will be slightly harder to get. So instead of 200 for the first bonus batting point, it's 250 and going up in 50s from there. So 450 for the fifth point rather than 400. And then I think the biggest one is going to be how many points you get for a draw. So it's going to be 5 points for a draw compared to 8 last season. Last season, with all the run scoring we had in the early summer, there were a lot of draws. And I kind of wonder if... Even though if you kind of look at last year's table, it wouldn't have changed that much if you had the current draw point system in. I do wonder that just seeing on a piece of paper at the start of the season that you only get 5 points for a draw just changes how you go about things.
Right. Well, okay. Well, let me address. Let's go back to the Kookaburra ball first.
Cool.
Because I've got a huge rant coming about bonus points thing. So we'll save that for last. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with the Kookaburra. My feeling is this. I played a long, long time back, obviously, but we played second team cricket with Kookaburra balls back in the early 90s. And the thing that we found was that even though the seam is slightly less pronounced, they swung like billy-o. I was going to use a much stronger word, but I went all Christian there for a second. They swung miles. The difference in what happens to a Kookaburra ball in the UK as opposed to what happens to it overseas in hotter climates where the pitches and the soil is much harder and more abrasive is that they actually maintain a shine much better. And they swing like you would not believe. So very, very interested to see how that turns out. One thing that it might, you know, spinners will quite enjoy it. You know, if it gets a little bit tacky and they can really wrap their fingers around it and get a bit of something on it. I don't think it's going to be the panacea. Yeah, a little bit like when they decided to use the Duke ball in Australia for the Shield rounds. They found that it was, you know, it was slightly disastrous. It nipped all over the place in the, you know, when it was brand new, which is what they were hoping for. But then, you know, the soil in Australia just ripped the thing to shreds and it became as useless as a Kookaburra does afterwards. So it's actually, and I go back to this all the time, the pitches are the most defining factor of what happens. The ball is always slightly secondary and it may have inverse consequences to the ones that are intended, but we'll see.
So it's possible that the Kookaburra ball does less than the Dukes when it's brand new, but over 20 onwards, it actually might do...
Well, no, because for some bizarre reason, the Kookaburra actually swings brand new in a way that the Duke doesn't.
Okay.
But what it does is it will keep doing it. It will keep swinging. I don't know. You know, they'll probably have to add some extra lacquer or something to it to waterproof it a bit better for UK conditions or whatever. But I remember, and it is a long time back, but I remember the thing just hooped and it just kept doing it. You know, it didn't get the sort of the buff knocked off it in the way that it does when you're playing with it in Australia or in South Africa. So it'd be interesting to see how that works out.
And then on 8 points for a draw going down to 5 points.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, the intention, I suppose, with 5 points for the draw is to try and make teams be more enterprising in terms of trying to gain victories, to get your captains to work a little bit harder, think about the amount of runs that you need to win a game as opposed to the amount of runs you need to make for bonus points, which brings me on to the bonus point system, which should disappear. I don't understand why we have one. Because if the intention is to play cricket for results, which is not to say that you play on pitches where a result happens in 2 days, that's where the people who are officially tasked with making sure that pitches are proper come in. Why bother making their 5 batting bonus points for 450? You might only need 380 to win the game. I've always thought that having bonus points is just the worst thing that you could possibly do in cricket, because what they are is a game within a game. You write off the bowling points because virtually everybody gets them. The whole time, 120 overs or whatever it is, you get to get your bowling points. So that's, they just work themselves out as being pretty much equal over the course of a summer. And then batting points are unnecessary because you should only score the amount of runs you need to win the game. You shouldn't be out there searching for an extra 50 just so that you get an extra point. It's nonsense. It's always been nonsense. It's still nonsense. And the fact now that you've give, that you've reduced the amount of draws in order to encourage teams to go for more wins kind of tells you that it's nonsense.
I guess playing devil's advocate, it's an incentive to produce better pitches.
But it doesn't work, does it? That hasn't worked. We've always had bonus points, and it's never made the slightest bit of difference. The only incentive you need is that there are penalties for pitches which have been underprepared on purpose, or prepared to suit a particular side's strength rather than producing the best pitches that you can possibly have. Mm. Here for my good pals, the groundsmen and the ones that I've spoken to, is why I'm not having a go at groundsmen, because I know what happens. Manager, director of cricket will go to the groundsman and say, "Oh, we want you to leave a bit of extra grass on it, or can you stick the hose on it for a good couple of days before the game because we've got X team coming?" Or they say, "Can you shave a bit off at this end because we want it to spin for our off spinner?" And they've got, you know, whatever it might be. I know how it works. Groundsmen don't go out there on purpose to produce pitches that are substandard, or at least that do too much. But sometimes they're put under pressure to make that happen. So look. The whole bonus points thing is completely and utterly ridiculous. We lose an enormous amount of cricket over the course of every summer because of the nature of our weather, right? So having incentives to bat out a day and a half in order to score 5 points and then pick up your points for the draw, why not just make it, well, the incentive there is to try and score enough runs to win the game, or to do it in an amount of time, as Ben Stokes did in Islamabad, to try and make the game move forward so you can put yourselves in a position where you play under pressure for a win.
Mm.
Now, all the while that there are bonus points to fall back upon and large amounts of points for draws, etc., that doesn't happen. You just go, well, okay, we've got X amount of games over the course of the season. We'll just make sure that we pick up our bonus points here and we'll move on to the next one. And then we wonder why you don't have captains who have got any kind of enterprise or brain power between them, so they don't need it. You just fall back on the amount of points that you can gather just simply by not playing for any sort of result whatsoever. I hated them when I played. Now, and the fact that they keep moving them around in order to, oh, we need to make the game more interesting, less draws or whatever it might be, just tells you that you don't need them in the first place. You have 6 points for a win, 2 points for a draw, nothing for nothing. That's it. Done.
I think you made your point quite clearly. Just to pick up on something you said about pitches, do you have a problem with counties tailoring pitches to suit their advantage? So, for example, Leicestershire, they've not won a game in 2 years. They've got Callum Parkinson, who's one of the best English finger spinners in the country, and they've got Rehan Ahmed, who's an 18-year-old legging with a Test 5 to his name.
Yeah.
Surely, you know, England go to India next year and... we've got a pretty good idea about what the pitch is going to be like there. They released half the series. Do you have an issue with a county like a Leicestershire changing their pitches from one season to another to suit the players they have at their disposal?
No, I don't. I don't have an issue with that. What I have an issue with is that you deliberately would underprepare or make a pitch less than playable in order to do that. I have no issue with them making sure that there's very little grass on, or making sure that they're going to turn or wear over the course of a game. That's no problem at all. I have no issue with teams, leaving a little bit of grass on and making sure that their seamers are in the game. I have no problem with that either. What I do have a problem with is kind of leaving them to such an extent, a little bit like India do. And here's another. There's more stuff coming from my inbox. But, you know, India found themselves, you know, with world-class batsmen who can't score any runs because they're playing on pitches that are woefully underprepared. And they have no reason to do so. They're a good team. Why would you do that? Mm. Completely mad. And that's what I have an issue with. So, of course, you will play to your advantage. that's what playing at home is all about. But you, but not to the point whereby the game becomes a lottery and you end up, you know, it's all over in a day and a half, 2 days. That's nonsense. That's not cricket at all.
Mm. I like how a bit on the county championship can still end up having a little dig at a couple of the pitches that we've seen in India over the last couple of years.
Well, yeah, but you know, I understand. I understand why it happens. I understand why it happens if you're not a very good team. I have sympathy for sides that kind of, you know, they struggle to bowl teams out, or they have masses of injuries and all those kinds of things, which means that they're slightly impotent. In which case, you might be a little bit naughty with the odd surface here or there. What I don't understand is why, if you've got world class fast bowlers, world class spinners, world class batters, you'd play on absolute dung heaps. I just don't get it.
Hmm. Well, either way, at Mark Butcher 72. if you've got any comments on that. Anyway, cheers for your time, Butch. Catch you next week or the week after. So, moving on to Division 2, Yorkshire are surely favourites, right? I don't think anyone will disagree with that. Darren Millan's going to be available for a lot of that early season, potentially even Johnny Bairstow as well. They're going to have Shah Massoud and Adam Lyth in the top order, recruited Matt Milnes from Kent. I found predicting who's going to finish second really, really difficult. The pack below Notts last season was pretty tight. Middlesex weren't that far above the rest, and those below Middlesex were all very compact. Does anyone want to make a bold early prediction for who's going to be second? Ben, do you want to go?
Well, I mean, it's...
That's but, bold.
Based on the fact they finished third last season, and there's a, you know, Glamorgan are, I think they're pretty well stocked. I mean, they'll still have Labuschagne for, you know, a fair amount of time. They've got Nisa, who will take lots of wickets. Hogan's a loss. But I think, I guess, yeah, it's just so tricky to predict, because especially when it can also depend on which teams are struggling down the bottom as well. Like, if you can get the results over teams at the right time kind of thing, then you go on, it's so hard. But I think I'd go with Glamorgan, basically.
You mentioned Sussex in the magazine, and the more I think about it, the more I like that idea.
They're the wild card, aren't they?
Do you want to explain why?
Well, they've been like truly dreadful for a few years.
Sure.
But if you go through their team, they've got two of the... They've genuinely got one of the best opening partnerships in either division, in Ali Orr and Tom Haynes. They can have Pujara. A guy called Steve Smith's going to play a few games, so they should be fine in the batting. But to be honest, they were for a lot of last season as well. Their bowling was extremely weak. They found taking 20 wickets very difficult, and they have a very good pitch at Hove. But if Ollie Robinson plays, and he's missed a lot of last season, if he plays a good chunk of games at the start, I think they're going to be a very, very difficult team to beat. And they've brought in Nathan McAndrew, and I know that he's not a name that really excites that much, but he's a major upgrade on a lot of their very young attack. The young crop there are all a year older. Jack Carson is highly rated and missed a lot of last season as well. So I can see them doing a lot better than they did last season, especially if Ollie Robinson starts, he's fit and firing. You know, a combination of him, a couple of guys who do okay with the ball, and a very, very good batting line up. Like, you can see how they go on a bit of a run in a way that you can't actually see that many other sides in the division doing, if that makes sense.
I think the most notable signing is Paul Farbrace coming in. Mm. And that is a dramatic shift from Ian Salisbury, who, you know, to his credit, had this kind of holistic approach to coaching, in that he wanted the county to benefit the whole system. He wanted to be producing young players on really good pitches who could go on and play for England, and there's a lot to be admired in that, but it makes it quite hard when you've got the flattest deck in the country and a young seam attack still struggling to find their way. Paul Farbrace came in, and I quoted him in the magazine: I haven't come here to continually help and develop a group of talented young players, I've come here to win. Well, Salisbury was almost saying the opposite. Mm. I mean, he wasn't saying I've come here to lose, that would be ridiculous, but he was saying the priorities are to build this side up over years. And I think one win in two Red Bull seasons for Sussex, patience was wearing thin with that approach. And Farbrace is, you know, as that quote suggests, is not going to come in and pussyfoot around and put arms around the shoulder. He wants to win games, and I think Sussex will play very different cricket, potentially on quite different pitches. That'll be really interesting to see what pitches they prepare at Hove. I think they're a real wild card, but I think I had them sixth or seventh, but I wouldn't be surprised if they end up coming in just behind Yorkshire.
I think Gloucestershire are going to be interesting. They struggled in Division 1, but their squad is very similar to last year's, but they've brought in Marshall to Langer as well to bolster the attack. And Joe, you made the point before we started recording that Zafar Gohar in Division 2 could just he could be the leading spinner easily in the division.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he could take a lot of wickets, and they've got a good top four. They've got a solid top four. Marcus Harris is back for another season. You've got Chris Dent, who's a reliable source of runs. James Bracey, who's had a difficult time of it since having his brief chance with England, but is a good player, and I suspect he'll come back strongly this year. And then Miles Hammond, who scored quite a few runs last year. I think that's solid enough to mean they'll definitely be in the mix. And then you throw in Gohar, and I think they might take that second spot behind Yorkshire.
Yeah, and the youngster Tom Price did pretty well in Division 1. I think he's only 21 or 22, and doing well in Division 1 last year. Not that many seamers actually did that, so that bodes well for this summer.
Yeah, Ryan Hings is a big loss, I guess we're saying. It's a big gain for Middlesex. I guess the thing as well is if they can get the pitches right in a way, I can actually see them winning games in quite almost like a traditional fashion. Like if they can have like a pitch that's sort of flat and they can get big runs on the first day and that just offers enough turn to go on the last day, because he does have a really good record. I felt like that was almost a lot of maybe quite late season wickets and also late in games as well, that I think he's a match winner with the ball, as well as being, you know, he's a tidy spinner that can do a job in the first innings. But I think to have that incision, he needs a little bit of help, which he was getting at times. And if they can get the pitches that allow them to get the big runs and then bowl sides out with Gohar, then that could be a bit of a recipe, I think.
It's a real point of difference in that there is a lack of quality spin in Division 2 as well. So you can kind of prepare pitches that will turn without being particularly fearful of what the opposition will do to you in response. So I think that really works in their favour.
In the magazine, there was a 10 burning questions section focusing on the county summer. Phil, one of those was about whether or not Leicestershire can win a game. It's an interesting one. They've got Rahane, but not until after the IPL. And then they've got Rahane Ahmed, who barely played last summer, but has now got a Test 5 foot and one of the most exciting players. One of the most exciting players in the world.
Yeah, probably so, their best batter, let alone his bowling.
Yeah, how do you see Leicester do it? I mean, it feels like with Rahane Ahmed, we might not get that long of him playing county championship cricket, so we might as well enjoy it whilst it lasts.
Enjoy the 18-year-old while he's still fresh. What's the point of Leicester's 4-day story? It's a tough one to answer. They'd have to try and answer that themselves. Those numbers are almost comical, really. And food for thought for the punters, right? You know, because they will have a fair few loyalists who will be traipsing down to Grace Road every Thursday morning, knowing pretty much full well what's going to transpire 3.5 days later.
But they've not thrown in the towel, have they? The fact that they've gone and got Rahane, who's playing Red Bull cricket and the One Day Cup, interestingly, but not part of the Blast. They don't need to make that signing, do they? If they're going to just throw in the towel for Red Bull cricket, you don't waste the money on an Indian Test star or former Indian Test star.
Well, firstly, I hear what you're saying. I don't disagree with it, but this is a marketing campaign, right? Leicestershire, and I remember when Wasim Khan was there, he was very, very clear on this. It has a densely multi-ethnic population. There's a lot of cricketing interest and a lot of passion around that area, and they want to try and harvest that and use that to replenish the club and to bring a kind of a fresh set of fans through. Now, the way to do that is to bring in the odd Indian icon, and they did it with Sehwag 10 years ago and so on and so on. So it makes sense within their policy. And while Rahane is going to be very useful for them in white clothing, he's going to be even more useful for them in coloured clothing, because that's when you do tend to get the numbers through. But of course, if one can bleed into the other, then all the better. I imagine also Rahane's probably made enough money in his time, and he probably quite fancies knocking around, you know, in lovely leafy East Midlands, yeah. You know, for a few months. Again, similar to the Northants story, but you root for them. You want them to find a way through. You want them to find a way to balance the competing challenges of being a modern county club in the modern era where there's so many requirements across the board now. You know, it's such a splintered game now. And it's very, very difficult. We're seeing it more and more. But that fact in itself holds me back from criticising them, because, you know, they're up against an immensely difficult ecosystem. They're one of four clubs within the Midlands, and we've seen how, you know, there's always that talent drain away from Leicester to the more lucrative, more well-heeled clubs up the road, such as Notts, and yet they do still bring through these cricketers, you know, from Broad to James Taylor to Rayan Ahmed now, and others that elude me, but they've always provided that more so than other bigger clubs. So they're a part of the story for sure, even if they do tend to bring up the rear come the end of September.
Mm.
And they've got, I mean, the struggle to keep hold of players continues. Callum Parkinson, who was their Red Bull skipper for much of last season, is no longer captain because he wouldn't commit his long-term future to the club, which would suggest, you know, he's eyeing up other options. I think he might be into the last year of his contract.
He is.
So yeah, it just goes on. I mean, brilliant news from that Rayan Ahmed signed a long-term contract at the end of last year or over the winter, perhaps. But like you say, they're not going to see a huge amount of him, probably. So yeah, enjoy him while you can. But it does seem odd they didn't play him. When you spoke to Jigga Naik, he said there had been some injury.
Yeah, yeah, no, he did have injury problems. So it was. I mean,
there were also some games where he wasn't.
Yeah,
picked,
I mean, he also did start last season, age 17. So there's that too.
And I guess also, as much as we say, you know, he's not going to play a huge amount for Leicester, he's not on the verge of nailing down a first choice spot for England in any format. I mean, he's very, very exciting. And there's obviously loads to like, and we've all seen how good he can be. But
there'll be franchise interest as well.
That's true, yeah. But he'll get a bit of time this season, at least. This might be the time when he gets some. So hopefully they can have arrive at a turning pitch somewhere, and then that'll maybe be where they get their one win. I don't know.
Mm. With all seriousness, with Callum Parkinson and Rohan Ahmed in your attack, like surely make a pitch that turns as much as possible. Like I remember when Matt Parkinson was on the podcast, he was talking about a game where he played against Callum, and he said he talked about how the pitch, if you're a young spinner, Grace Road has been a really, really difficult place to be a young spinner in the last few years compared to a place like Old Trafford. So you'd think that with the talent they've got in Parkinson and Rahan, they would surely try to manufacture conditions to suit them.
Especially with the games when they've got Rahan as well.
Mm, absolutely. So the three teams we've not mentioned yet are Worcestershire, Derbyshire and Durham, who finished fourth, fifth, sixth last summer in Division 2. And I think all three of them are very much in the mix for promotion. So just on Durham, I think any side with Potts and Brydon Carst, if he remains fit, are going to be up there by the end of the season. Big if, granted. But those are two of the most exciting bowlers in the division.
Ben Rain as well as a third seam, a very useful bowler at that level.
Very, very useful.
They're an interesting story as well. They've got this kind of Dutch element to their side now. Ryan Campbell, the former Dutch coach, has come in replacing James Franklin and brought in two Dutch internationals, which has a kind of different feel to it. I think they underperformed last year, really. Mm. I thought they should be in the mix for promotion. They were actually sort of, where did they come last year? Sixth last year.
Yeah.
They're probably slightly better than that. Mm. David Beddingham's a really good player.
They've lost Sean Dixon, who's gone to Somerset. He was their opening bat last year, did well, made a triple, I think, maybe year before last. Mm. But they've lost him, a bit of a blow. Michael Jones, Scottish keeper bat or bat keeper, he's a good cricketer, really good cricketer. I saw him make a very, very good 80 odd last year.
Ollie Robinson is the other Ollie Robinson. We're going to get to him a bit later, but Joe, that's a very, very good signing, and potentially someone who could be at the club for the next 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, Kent didn't want to lose him, but they have a lot of keeper bats. Really good signing for Durham.
And the other two sides, Worcestershire and Derbyshire. I guess with Worcestershire, what a player I'm going to pick out later on, Kashif Ali, talked about him before in the pod, but he broke his thumb, I think, at the end of last season, where he was set to play quite a lot in the county championship. So he's still only played one county championship game. They've just got Ed Pollock on he's just signed a new deal. They've got Adam Hose back. I don't know how much Red Bull cricket he's going to play, but he's really established himself as one of the better uncapped white ball players in the country. So I don't know. Don't know quite how he's going to go.
When they signed him, I think it was Alan Richardson. Yeah, I think he said, no, it wasn't. It was Paul Pridgeon, who is their sort of director of cricket role.
Yeah.
They want him to play red ball cricket. They bought him with a view to playing red ball cricket.
And that's why he left, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. They're going to be a really watchable team, Worcester. So they've got those two that you mentioned, a couple of dashers basically in Hose and Pollock, but they've also got Jack Haynes, one of the best young stylists in the country, who made 300s in 3 weeks last year. But they've also got this cohort of quicks. I think we might be mentioning one or two of them later on. But if you look at, again, going back to the Northants Leicester point, they produce really good young English cricketers. And they've got Barnard's gone to Warwickshire because he's outgrown New Road in effect. But they've got Pennington, Josh Tongue, Mitchell Stanley. They've got some really good young quicks, proper quicks as well. So they're doing something right. It might not necessarily show up in final league positions, but again, they're doing a lot of things right.
And similarly, Derbyshire, Mickey Arthur's Derbyshire, obviously losing Sean Massoud, who scored all those runs at the start of last season, that is a big loss. But, and I look down their lineup and I think probably still short on batting, even though they've got Lewis Deploy and Wade Madsen. But
they made a lot of runs last year, though.
Yeah,
again,
that's true.
Playing on a very flat pitch, struggled to get wins. Yeah, I think more the issue for me is their seam attack. Sam Connors bowled really well last year, got on the Lions side, and there's talk about him being the first Derbyshire player to play for England for a long, long time. I think since Dominic Cork might be in Test cricket. Lakmal, who they signed on a 2-year deal, went down pretty much straight away last year, but is coming back for his second year. So they'll hope that he can get through the season much better than he did. But it's that seam attack that would stop me saying they're genuine promotion contenders, but I think they're probably more mid-table.
It's worth mentioning as well, just that point on draws not being worth as much, that goes even more for Division 2 than Division 1 last year. So only Sussex and Leicester lost more than 3 games last year in Division 2. So, but those sides, they're going to have to just turn draws into wins, and that'll be really important.
Just back on Derbyshire's attack, Zach Chappell is an interesting signing. People have talked about him for years as being like an exciting quick, but he didn't really get that much of a look in.
Another Leicester product.
Yeah. And George Scrimshaw as well. He was a rare bright spark in a dismal Welsh Fire team in the 100 last year. And there's one game, there's a televised game where he bowled really, really well in the blast for Derbyshire. So he's got pace. So he's not really yet converted that into Red Bull success. But
Zach Chappell is well worth that mention. We did a thing in the magazine maybe 3 years ago now, and Kevin Shine, who was involved in the UCB's fast bowling program, picked him out as a really, really good, talented young bowler. He's had injury issues. It's not worked out for him. He went to Gloucester last year on loan, did well in 20-over cricket. I think had a couple of four-day games towards the end of the season, did okay. If he can stay fit, he's tall, he's got a bit of pace. You know, in Div 2, that might be very useful for them.
And they've got a genuinely world-class coach. I mean, Mickey Arthur's about it. It's kind of still a bit odd that he's there, with no disrespect to Derbyshire. Just, he's coached pretty much every Test nation going. And he's pitched up at Derbyshire and loves county cricket. It's a brilliant story. I think, I would, if it was done to preference, I'd have them going up this year. But I think they might be a little bit short.
And to finish, we're going to pick out our ones to watch for the summer. So we've got 4 categories. We've got an overseas one to watch, a first team newbie. So this is someone who basically hasn't played that much first team cricket. Then a breakthrough player who's, I guess, one level above that. Someone who did play a fair bit last year, but has not really had a standout season yet. And then a test bolter, someone who could conceivably force their way into test contention in the next 12 or so months. Phil, do you want to go first?
So my first team newbie is Mitchell Stanley, just mentioned. Big, strong, strapping quick from Worcester. Who only played T20 games last year, but made his mark. He's everything you'd look for in a young quick. What he doesn't have, of course, is Red Bull experience. It might be that he'll be kept at arm's length, but if they do throw him the ball, then he'll be well worth watching. He has all of those components for a classic fast bowling unknown on Tuesday night and talk of the town on the Wednesday morning. Test bolter Bryden Carse. Not played a test match yet, but they like him a lot. He's played some ODIs. If he can stay fit, etc., etc. He's good, strapping, quick. Joey Everson. So he's gone to Kent from Notts. He was a star in the under-19s England side. he's highly rated. I was speaking to his batting coach actually a couple of weeks ago. He's saying he's looking in good spirits, good form. I think Kent have bought him with a view to playing him across all the formats. He bowls a bit as well. Kind of cricketer that might go well. You never know.
He's basically their Darren Stevens replacement.
That's it. Yeah,
He's a classic Kent signing in that he like completely dominated the second 11 stuff whilst not being able to get looking at knots.
Yeah,
although he's definitely more of a batter than a bowler at this stage. Yeah, whereas Stevens, you'd say, was the flip side of that at this point.
Yeah.
But
By the end, if he is going to be a Stevens replacement, he's got a few years.
So. Oh, that's true. Yeah. So his bowling will really come on when he's about 35.
Yeah, exactly. can I just say on Mitchell Stanley, because I was jealous when Phil got that as his pick. His story of how he kind of got into became recognised last year. So I think it was in a T20 Blast game, basically his third or fourth game he was playing for Worcestershire, and he was opening the bowling to Joss Butler, and second or third ball nicks him off and gets Butler's dropped at slip. But Butler is then Manchester Originals captain, and they sign up Stanley maybe as a wild card or as a replacement player, and he's gets him right in the team. And his first over, he reached 90 miles an hour in his first over. So he's not just one of these, he's pretty quick guys. And obviously, you wouldn't expect him to sustain that over the course of a counter-championship game if he plays. But like when you're bowling 90 miles an hour, you are instantly one of the fastest bowlers in England.
I think it was Sam Hain, might be wrong, but I think it was Sam Hain, pretty sure it was him, that he clean bowled with a classic. Like a Dale Steiner, you know, one that swings late from middle to clip the base of off stump. And when something like that happens, suddenly you sit up and take notice. He also sounds like an Aussie, Mitchell Stanley. He sounds like he's born in, you know, on the Gold Coast. But
you put it really well last season that when he rocked up, you thought he was a BBL player who we haven't really paid attention to.
I was watching him in 100. I was like, oh, this is another guy who's taken a few wickets in the Big Bash and has got a 100 deal at the last minute.
And the overseas, well, I had Will Sutherland this morning from Essex, but now I don't have him because he's not coming. I don't really know, but Shaun Masood is an obvious, you know, linchpin for Yorkshire. And if Neil Wagner can play a few games in his slipstream for Yorks, then he will also be very useful, although there is an injury cloud over him.
Ben?
Yes. So, feels like my first team bolter, is that what we called it? Or first team?
First team newbie.
First team newbie.
You're mixing two categories there.
Sorry. Yeah. My first team newbie. It feels like a bit of a cheat, but then he hasn't even played 5 first-class games, which is Jacob Bethel, who feels like we've talked about him for years and years and years on the podcast and elsewhere. Obviously had that amazing under-19 World Cup knock, and they love him at Warwickshire. Maybe it's hard to see where he fits into that first team, but you know, at some point he is going to have a breakthrough season or he's going to fade away, and either one of those is kind of interesting, I guess.
This is definitely the list that he put together 5 minutes before the start of the show, which he didn't even think he was on. Oh, that Jacob Bethel, the one who captained England in the under-19s about 5 minutes ago.
I put a bit more time than that, maybe. And then my test bolter, not newbie test bolter, is Tom Hartley, who isn't a bolter for this season, but I think by the end of within 12 months, England have got a tour of India at the start of next year, and they may well want a sort of a proper offie, I guess, having made do with Jax, I guess, in the winter at times. As we said earlier, he was out bowling Matt Parkinson at Lancashire by the end of the season. He does bat as well. I think he got a century off a very small amount of balls in the pre-season. He's tall. I think there's quite a lot to like about him as a bowler. And the last one is the first team prospect. Is that right?
The breakthrough player.
Breakthrough player. Sorry. Okay. The breakthrough player I had is, it's not just the names of the things. The breakthrough player I had is Jamie Smith, who again we've mentioned before, but in that Surrey team, I guess again you struggle to see, is he going to start the season, especially with Sibley in the side? Are they going to go Sibley, Burns, Patel at the top three, or can Jamie Smith possibly break in there? But when it comes to sort of the county championship and the England test players are not in contention anymore, especially when Ben Folkes is missing out, then he has a real chance there. And there's also, I think it's as much for the fact that he could break into the Surrey first team as that England don't really have, it's hard to see who the next keeper is after Ben Folkes, which will be in a long time. But still, if you're thinking like looking at who's a guy who might be playing test cricket, quite a lot of test cricket in like 5 or 6 years time, Jamie Smith is a candidate for that, I guess.
On the Surrey top four, I think it will be Burn, Sibley, Pope at three.
Yes, sorry.
And Smith at four. My newbie is Kashif Ali. as I said, talked about him before, he only played one first class game. I think he'll get a spot in the Worcestershire top six. My test bolter, similar thinking with Ben and Jamie Smith. I think Jordan Cox at Kent, he had a really good summer last year. Franchises are interested in him, and you never know if Butler stays away from test cricket. They'll need a spare keeper next winter. If he has another very good summer, I think he's already been in an England squad, an ODI T20 squad, granted, but England are already clearly interested in him. Breakthrough player, James Rue, played a bit at the end of last season, still only 19. And overseas, Dane Patterson at Notts. He is he's 33, been around for a while, but he's taken 137 wickets at 20 since the start of the 2021 summer. And we talked about Notts earlier. If the batting lineup goes well, it'll be interesting to see how players like Patterson and Patterson White step up from having dominated Division 2. So a good season for Patterson could go some way to determining how well Notts end up doing. Joe?
My overseas is Haider Ali at Derbyshire. Really exciting signing. They've obviously lost Shamasu to Yorkshire, and Miki Arthur's dived back into his contacts book again and come up with Haider. He's 22-year-old Pakistani. England fans might remember his T20i debut where he smashed a 50 against England at Old Trafford 3 years ago. Now he's only 19 at the time. He's playing all formats in theory for the whole season, so kind of old school county signing. He's only played 11 first-class games in Pakistan, but scored a few hundreds. And yeah, it'll just be fascinating to see how he goes. I think there's no guarantee that he'll score Red Bull runs at all. It could actually go horribly wrong, but I think it'll be fun whichever way. And I think he'll score a lot of white ball runs for Derbyshire. My breakthrough player, previously mentioned, Ollie Robinson at Durham, who's been around for a little while, but struggled for opportunities at Kent because they've got Cox and Billings. He got fed up of waiting for a Red Bull spot. And he'll bat in the middle order, I think, for Durham. Scored a double century whilst on loan at Durham in the One Day Cup last year. And I think he's talked about as a potential successor to Ben Folkes in a few years' time. So good one to watch. Test bolter, Josh Tung at Worcestershire. Still only 25, unbelievably. Feels like he's been around for ages. You know, tall, quick, bit like Andy Caddick. Suffered horribly with injuries. He's only played... had this stat here, 16 first class games since the start of 2019, so he's got some catching up to do. Only played three last year, but Alan Richardson, who stepped up to be head coach, says he's fit as he's ever seen him, bowling fast, described him as having like a new signing. And he was part of the England Lions squad that toured Sri Lanka, took 8 wickets in one of the unofficial test matches, and he's just a fast bowler who looks like he could be a test quick, just needs to stay on the pitch long enough to prove that. And then finally, my first team newbie, Tom Prest at Hampshire, who was the England Under-19 World Cup captain, took them to the final last year, made some white ball runs for the Lions in Sri Lanka just last month, and scored 180 from 138 balls in the Royal London last year against Kent. So already really proven himself as a white ball player. Didn't play any championship cricket at all for Hampshire last year, which I found a bit odd given their batting struggles. He's another player who'll come out and whack it, whatever the format, I expect. And given that Hampshire haven't got the sort of proven top order batter in that I thought they might, then I think he's probably going to get a decent go. So I'd definitely keep an eye on him too.
One thing I forgot to mention when picking out my test bolter was England's next 10 tests after the Ireland game are 5 at home to Australia and I think 5 away to India. I think the last time England played 5 test matches against India and then 5 test matches against Australia, well, I know this is the other way around, the team changed quite a lot between the first one of those and the end of those. And I was going to pick an opener, but I just couldn't decide which one.
But there's hope for Josh Bohannon yet.
I think there's something in that. So we glossed over the who's in the mix, who's in the slipstream of the England test side earlier on. But I think it's a little bit more open than we think it is. And if you take, say, what happened to Alex Lees last year, it's not like it's a completely closed shop. And it's amazing what an Ashes series does for exposing players. And especially if you're down in the series, then, you know, even in this kind of, you know, Zen-like yucca plant sort of new era, they're still going to panic a little, not panic, but they're still going to be moved to make decisions if they are down in that series. And then for sure, you know, Hamid, Compton, all of these kinds of players, these
Tom
opening
Haynes,
bats.
Tom Haynes, Ali Orr.
There's loads and loads of players who will be eyeing up those opening berths. And sure, Duckett is 60% and Crawley is 40%. But, and injuries as well, broken fingers, early season broken fingers, all the rest of it. Golfing injuries where you break multiple parts of your leg. I mean, all sorts of weirdness happens.
Yeah.
And I think that's the area. That's obviously the area, right? That middle order, barring injuries, is pretty sewn up. And the question is how you get Bairstow back into it if you do.
Mm.
But up the top, for sure. For sure, that's open.
And also, like, good players have crap home Ashes series and crap series in India. So you can see someone who's still very, very talented. You know, I think we've made the point before that even if you think they are really talented, if you just have that many bad test matches, the numbers get really ugly, really quite quickly. And it can be a bit of a downward spiral. I think Pope really suffered from that. From once you're in one of those, it can be quite difficult to get out of.
Yeah.
And we also with Crawley's county record, which is not good, as we all know, however much they want to stick with him, we could get to a point that we get to the first test of the Ashes or the Ireland test, and he just hasn't scored any runs for Kent. And you can't just keep picking him. I know they don't necessarily put that much store in county cricket, but there's a point where it's actually just, you know, clearly wrong. And if he hasn't got the early runs for Kent, then it might be that the change has to be made, even if they don't really want to do it.
The one I'm really looking forward to seeing, because I just love watching him play, is Hamid. Now, I think he's been slightly unfortunate with the timing of his England returns, and I think throwing him in at Brisbane was hiding to nothing, really. But he did okay against India's quicks in the home series on obviously English pitches. Now, Australia's quicks will bother him and shake him up. But the way he played last year, albeit in Div 2, he went at 65 runs per 100, right? That's a good lick. And he made 1,200 runs and he made 400s. And they were beautiful, the bits that I saw. It might be that this is his level, right? And that he never sniffs an England cap again. And if so, then so be it. But he's the one I'm really interested in watching this year, I think.
So the one similar category for me, I'm really interested in, is Burns. I think if the panic button does get pressed, you've got a guy who 4 years ago averaged 40 against this Australia side in a home Ashes series. You know, there aren't that many guys in the country you can say that about. And I think if they are looking for someone who, I guess he is the person in the county game who I think you can most confidently say could make that step back up straight away, I think. Because he has done it,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, I can see the logic. I have my doubts that him, with his age, with his quixotic styles, fits into the way that they see it. But then I guess the same questions could be raised against a Hamid and so on.
Anyway,
it's all good fun, though.
It is all good fun, and we've got a good 8 weeks to go for Ashes build-up. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Ben. That is the end of part one.
So, Katia, on, finally, to some actual cricket that's actually been played this week. Let's start with the IPL. All teams were in action over the weekend, with Game 6 going on as we speak. There were big wins for RCB, Rajasthan Royals and Lucknow Supergiants, a slightly tighter win for Punjab Kings, and one properly close win for the Gujarat Titans over CSK. We're not going to get into the details of every game. Kohli got some big runs. Carl Mayer's got some big runs. There were, you know, all the things you've come to expect from the IPL. But you were very impressed, as everyone was, with Mark Wood, who took 5-14 in that LSG win and bowled very, very quickly.
Yeah, he bowled brilliant. He bowled absolute wheels, as always. In fact, I think the only bad ball he bowled was his hat-trick delivery. So he got Prithvi Shaw and then Mitchell Marsh with some brilliant 148 kph, I think it was, through the gate, and then dragged it halfway down the pitch to Safras Khan, who came in. I think he slipped, though, so maybe there's some mitigating factors in there. But yeah, he bowled really, really well. And it's quite nice, after he was injured out of last year's competition, to come back, I think, in his second game ever in the IPL. I think that's right. So yeah, that's quite nice. But then I think he got panned today by MS Dhoni. So yeah, maybe some cause for calm on the Mark Wood hype train.
Yeah, I guess that's what cricket can do. I really enjoyed watching Virat Kohli bat yesterday. I mean, he's always nice to watch bat, but he had a great bat with Jofra Archer. There was a stat going around that it was the most runs scored by a single batter off Archer in a T20 game, which is obviously a good stat. But I thought it was almost cooler how many bowls Kohli faced off him. It was like he's deliberately saying, I'm going to take this guy down. Like, I'm the best guy on my team. I'm going to take down the best guy on their team. And the knock from Tilak Varma in the first innings of that game actually was, in my opinion, I think the innings of the competition so far, he looks really, really good. One innovation this tournament is the impact player rule, where a team can sub in one player for another at pretty much any stage, whereas it's the end of an over, fall of a wicket, end of the innings or something. It's been used in pretty much every inning so far, I think. Teams have taken the opportunity. What do you make of the rule? Do you think it's good? And do you think teams are using it well and stuff?
I think it's slightly overcomplicated, and I think that's not helped by people doing a bad job of explaining it, maybe. Mm-hmm. But
as I probably just did.
No. but I think you've got to give it time, right? We're what, on the fourth day of the tournament, sixth match maybe? So no one's going to know how to use it like straight away. And we've seen today that the second time in a row, Ambati Rayudu has been subbed out for Deshpande, and both times Deshpande's had a bit of a mare coming into bowl. I think he went for over 50 in the last game in less than four overs, and he's just bowled an 11 ball over to Carl Mayers. So that's not been a great use of it. But the most interesting one was LSG, really, wasn't it? Because they brought in, I think it's Krishnapagautam.
Yeah,
in the for the final ball of the inning. So they had Ravi Bishnoi, I think it was. He was going... No, it wasn't Ravi Bishnoi. It was... I can't remember.
Ayush Bedoni had got out.
Ayush Bedoni, that was it. He was doing really well, and he got out with one ball left in the innings. And they did have Ravi Bishnoi, Avesh Khan and Mark Wood to come in. And I think it's safe to say that none of them were going to do as much off the last ball. So they subbed in Gautam, who hit a six off the final ball, and then bowled really well. I think he took 0 for 20 odd. So that was a really good use of it. And that's what the impact player's meant to do. It's meant to be that extra tactical layer to the tournament. And it's meant to, you know, if teams are light with the bat, they can bring in an all-rounder, or they can bring in another specialist batter. And if they're light with the ball, they can bring in another bowler. But I think there's been a pattern emerging where the side batting first have brought in a bowler. Mm-hmm. And the side bowling first have done the reverse. They've brought in a batter. So maybe that's the initial thoughts on how to use the rule, but I'm sure we'll see more exploration of how to use that as the tournament goes on. I'm not sure just constantly subbing out Ambati Rayudu is going to be the best use of the tactical element of the rule. But yeah, no, I think it's been good, and it has given that extra level of something new to a tournament that's been going on for so long now. And I think it's a good-ish innovation, but again, it is too soon to tell.
Yeah, I guess it is objectively funny when, like, this happens with Deshpande or Navdeep Saini gets subbed in and goes for 34 in two overs.
Yeah.
That is quite funny, but I'm actually not a huge fan of the rule overall, I think. I think I'm in favour of injury subs in general, and that was actually how one of them was used, I think, when Kane Williamson, who's out of the tournament, injured his knee in the opening game. But I feel like this does have some tactical dimensions, but I think it also actually takes quite a lot away in terms of how you build a team, I think, which is something that I actually find quite interesting. The sort of, like, some people call it, like, the short blanket theory, where you can either definitely have enough bowling, but then you leave yourself lifetime batting, or have enough batting and then you're kind of fiddling around for that fifth bowler. This kind of takes away that whole aspect of team building, which I think is a bit of a shame. Abhishek Mukherjee, who's the head of Concept Business India, wrote quite an interesting article looking at what the effect might be for how it develops players, and this makes all-rounders quite a lot less important, I guess, because you can effectively just have an all-rounder who is two players with the impact player rule. But it might also mean that you have less batters sort of adopting an anchor role, because if there is a collapse, then you can just bring in an extra batter and that lengthens your batting order that way. But as you say, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
I think I can see that. I'm not a massive fan of the anchor role for a batter in T20 cricket anyway. I think it actively takes away from the spectacle from my point of view. And I quite like, I think the tactical element of deciding who your impact player should be and when they should come in makes up for the tactical element of trying to find a bowler to bowl another two overs or something at the end of the innings, or trying to jog your bowlers and getting it wrong, that kind of thing. But again, it is so soon, and we don't know how it's going to be used. And I think there's definite tweaks to the rule that could be made, especially in terms of the naming of the five players. I think five is possibly a little bit too many. I think you could narrow that down by at least one or two, maybe. And that would maybe make it slightly better. But I see where you're coming from on it, but I disagree.
Yeah, okay. Well, there'll be more on the IPL as it carries on, as we get properly into the tournament. Onto ODI cricket, which actually had a very important week this week, even though it's sort of maybe a bit in the margins of everything else that was going on. So Sri Lanka were beaten 2-0 by New Zealand and South Africa beat the Netherlands 2-0. Aidan Markram made his maiden ODI century in the last game of that Netherlands series, which he extended to 175, which is nice for him. But that those results mean that Sri Lanka and West Indies will be in the Cricket World Cup qualifier. So I guess they'll probably be the two favourites to go through from that. But, you know, there's no guarantees. And we saw with the last event how close both Afghanistan and West Indies were to missing out. So in that qualifier as well will be Zimbabwe and Netherlands, along with Scotland, Oman, Nepal, and probably two of USA, UAE and Canada, although there's a World Cup qualified playoff which is yet to finish, from which two teams will progress. And Ireland, it's so the last spot to progress automatically is between Ireland and South Africa now. Ireland will be in the qualifier unless they can beat Bangladesh 3-0. They might also need a bit of a net run rate swing, but it's not completely clear whether South Africa will take a net run rate hit for forfeiting the Australia ODIs, if that makes sense. Like if you forfeit a game in football, you take a 3-0 loss, so to speak. And I don't know if that will be the case for this one. Katia, you've watched a fair bit of Ireland recently on their tour of Bangladesh, where they've just played and lost ODI and T20I series. The series in the World Cup Super League is being played in Chelmsford to try and guarantee three full games. Do you think is a 3-0 win, is that too much to ask, do you think? Or is it possible that they could get that?
I think it's possible. Most things are possible. But I don't know. It's difficult because Ireland will be better than they were in Bangladesh in English conditions as they will be in Chelmsford.
And Bangladesh will be worse as well, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Although the interesting bit about the ODI series in particular was that it was Bangladesh's pace bowlers that were the difference. True. Like they were really, really good. Was Taskin Ahmed, he got a fiver or was... No, I think it was actually Shakib, so I've got that wrong. But no, Bangladesh have been really, really good and they looked the complete white ball unit when they were playing Ireland. They scored... In the first ODI, they scored 338, which was a record score for them. And then they beat it 3 days later, again against Ireland, in a match that they would have won if it hadn't been washed out in Ireland's innings. And then they beat them by 10 wickets, having bowled them out for about 100 in the final match with like 35 overs left to spare or something. So it was a proper...
And that was another record, wasn't it?
So, yeah. It was a proper drubbing. And then the T20 series started the same way before Ireland managed to pull one back at the end. But I can't see the difference in conditions being so much to make up for that. And it's not to say that like Ireland can't beat Bangladesh. They can. And they definitely haven't been at their best in Bangladesh. They haven't given a showing of themselves that is representative of what they should be capable of as a side. They also haven't had Josh Little. And they haven't had a couple of other players as well, I think. But I don't think we should be underestimating just how good Bangladesh are. They are a really, really good white ball side. We've just seen it with the England series as well, that they're more than capable of beating established, you know, England are the World Cup champions, you know. I don't know. From my understanding of it, Ireland have to win those three ODIs and then they'll be level on points with South Africa in eighth place.
Yes.
So they're going to have to beat them and then beat them by some in order to overtake the net run rate, not taking into account what happens with South Africa's net run rate.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I can't see them beating them 3-0. They might beat them 2-1. They might lose a series 2-1. I don't know, but I can't see them beating them 3-0. And secondly, I can't see them beating them by enough in Chelmsford consistently to overhaul that net run rate deficit. Could happen, you know, what do I know? I'll probably get it wrong. But, you know, I think it'll be tough for them considering what's happened in Bangladesh.
And I guess they've got just a big few months coming up with four tests in the next up until what the end of June is it when that England test is, and that will
I think it is end of June. But yeah, they haven't played a test in nearly 4 years. Like the last time they played it was at Lord's against England in that test match, that mad test match that happened in 2019.
So it's more tests in the next what, 3 or 4 months than they've played in their entire history up to this point.
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be a big month for Irish cricket. They've got three tests in 3.5 weeks at the minute. The first against Bangladesh tomorrow, where I think they could field like seven debutants, including PJ Moore, who is not a test debutant because he switched from Zimbabwe. And Matt Humphreys, who is yet to play a first-class game. So I couldn't, in the research that I did, I couldn't find an example of someone doing that before, making their first-class debut in a test match. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened, but you're going back is what I'm trying to say. So yeah, it's going to be a big match tomorrow. First time Andy Balburnie is going to lead them out in a test match as well. Mm. So that's a big one. But yeah, no, big month for Irish cricket.
Mm. Well, that is it for this show. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back to a more normal format next week. But still, if you did enjoy, please make sure to subscribe and maybe even leave us a nice 5-star review on the app. Cheers.
Podcast Network.